And Yvonne Kiernason, thank you. And we're going to wrap it up. And that's been another edition of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We'll see you again soon.
Spirit. Everyone's favorite atheist, Dan Barker, talks about his new book, God, the Most Unpleasant Character in All Fiction.
I, the Lord, am lifting up your skirts. In other words, the God of the Old Testament is taking credit for wartime rape of the Israelite women, and he's bragging about it.
Listen to weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/progressive spirit.
Oh Lord, please don't burn us.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 10:59 a.m. Coming up at 11, we round out the morning with the incomparable Radio Zine. This week featuring Digital Divide with your host, Rabia Yaman. We'll be speaking with Brian Christian, co-author of the new book, Algorithms to Live By, The Computer Science of Human Decisions, and with Shauna Scott about the upcoming Open Source Bridge Conference. So keep it tuned right here.
And welcome to the Digital Divide. This is your host, Rabia Yaman. And we've got a great show for you today. We're going to kick it off by talking live in studio with Shauna Scott, co-chair of this year's Open Source Bridge Conference. So welcome to the Digital Divide, Shauna.
Thank you, Rabia.
I'm just going to read from your website.
Sure.
The goal of the Open Source Bridge, because people that might not even know what that is or not recognize that we're talking about open source technology.
Sure.
So it says Open Source Bridge's purpose is to gather a diverse citizenry and inspire one another to make the world a better place through open source technology and open culture principles. So tell us a little bit more just about the organization in general.
Sure. So Open Source Bridge as a conference has been around for 8 years now. We exist in Portland to support open source community and we work with a nonprofit called Stumptown Syndicate that puts on our event and several other events throughout the year. And their whole goal is to kind of bring people together, build up the open source community, and provide resources that are necessary to help sustain the infrastructure of open source and of the people who work in it.
For our listeners who don't really understand what open source means, can you like provide a further definition of what it means in the context you're talking about it? I mean, is that programming, different kinds of languages? Is it, I don't know, what,
sure.
What is open source?
Yeah, so open
free
source.
Free pictures on the internet.
Open source usually refers to open source like software. So that can be projects that programming projects that the infrastructure of, you know, our entire technological system is built on. But that we take a more expansive view that we want open source to include the people, to include the design work and the marketing work, all of the people who contribute to helping build open technology, open society. So I think that includes KBOO Radio too, as well.
Well, I would agree with that in that context for sure, because we definitely are a resource for the community in really, I think, a bigger way than most people realize with all of the training opportunities and how many volunteers will really create all of the content for this radio station 24 hours a day, which is kind of unheard of in community radio. Other radio stations, when they visit, are like, how do you get so many people? We're like, you can't get rid of them.
Yep. We have the same thing with our conference. We have hundreds of volunteers that put in, you know, probably thousands of hours a year to put on this great event for everybody. We have, you know, several hundred speakers. We just actually announced our schedule last night. So if you want to see our schedule, you can go to our website. And
which is?
It's opensourcebridge.org.
And that will, and so where and when is the conference?
Yeah, it's going to be in Portland, Oregon at the Elliott Center, kind of 12th and Southwest Salmon if you're local. And it's going to be June 21st through the 24th. So the first 3 days will be our general conference session days, and then the last day will be our unconference. So if you're someone in the community who wants to attend, but maybe you only have one day, our unconference is available to the community for a sliding scale fee. So you could do that.
So what could someone expect to, you know, see or hear, or I don't know, taste, smell at the conference? What could they expect?
So we actually have some wonderful keynoters talking this year. We're focusing a lot on the idea of sustainability. Open source is kind of going through this sea change in a way where we're understanding that we've built all of these huge technological systems that our society depends on, and they've been built on the backs of people who aren't getting paid for that work, and who don't have a lot of resources and support to maintain those things, which is a really terrible way to maintain your infrastructure. So we're really interested in exploring how do you make those systems, you know, usable for everybody so that you can still have open source, but also something that can be maintained over time and people can actually have their work appreciated and valued in a way that's useful. So we have some keynoters who are going to be speaking on different facets of that. We have Audrey Eshright talking about creating a third wave of free and open source software. We also have Shauna Gordon-McKean, who's going to be talking about free culture in an expensive world, and Julia Nguyen, who's going to be exploring mental illness with open source. So I'm really excited about them and some of our other speakers who are going to be talking about business and theory and practice and culture and lots of different topics throughout the week.
Can you give our listeners some examples of how open source technologies maybe are used in their everyday lives? They don't see it, but how? What are some recognizable ways that everyday people are interacting with open source?
Sure. Your pretty much every bit of technology that you use interacts with open source in some way. Everything down to the way that the time gets set on any of your technological devices, that's all from an open source library. If you use any sort of programming language at all, almost all of them are open source. If you ever use a web browser, there's tons of open source technology in there. A lot of that, you know. So lots of different ways that you are interacting with all this technology every day without even realizing it.
Well, so open source doesn't mean free necessarily.
Right. That's true.
So people, companies, corporations, they use the programming. It's a shared language. It's like a basis that anybody can come and build on. Is that right? Would that be a pretty simplistic but accurate explanation, or is that inaccurate?
You know, I am not the best authority on the politics of free versus open software. So to all of the people who do have a lot of information about that, if I say something wrong, I apologize. But that sounds somewhat accurate to me. Open source can be something that people can use for free, or it can be something that can be licensed in lots of different ways. So there's a lot of different ways to kind of remix how open source works and how it interacts with free software and copyleft and all that.
I think that's important to clarify, because yeah, I think that if you're just an end user and you're not in the technology field, that when you hear open source, like in my mind, because I don't really work in the open source field, I don't know why I associate it with Wiki.
Yeah.
I just associate it with Wiki, which is open source.
Right.
But then I immediately go to free.
Right.
My mind, that's the next place I go. Mm-hmm. Is, oh, I get free pictures there. I can get free information.
Right.
And everybody shares it. But it's not always free. Sometimes it's simply the components of open source software that corporations or companies might use to build whatever application they are. Mm-hmm. And it's not always on the web either.
No, it's not always on the web.
It might be in your car.
Mm-hmm.
Or your refrigerator or your thermostat. I mean, it could be.
Increasingly, anything with wires is going to have open source in it in some way.
And do you think that there's, and I realize this might not be a question that, you know, you're prepared to answer, but because we're a little off topic from the conference, but it's such an interesting subject. Do you think that open source has more potential for the future than, say, proprietary software?
Ooh. That's
It's kind of a tough one.
I was
going
to say,
right?
you have other guests who are supposed to come on this hour, right?
Well, we do have a pre-recorded interview that I did last week with author Brian Christian on how to use algorithms to make decisions in your everyday life.
That's super interesting. Yeah. As far as
it's okay. You could just say, you know what? Come to the conference and ask.
Definitely.
Ask,
I think
an expert.
We're going to have a lot of people who are going to look at a lot of different aspects about that at the
conference. But someone could get a question like that answered at the conference from someone who's kind of working in that avenue of technology.
For sure. People who have way more experience than me.
So will we expect that it's a series of Are workshops I guess we could call it conferences, happening concurrently? Are they all sequential? How's it going to be set up?
Sure. So, like I said, the first 3 days are when all of the talk and workshop sessions are. So, some of those will be kind of shorter, 45-minute lectures. Others will be longer. I think 90-minute workshop sessions where you can do some interactive things. And we've got everything from, you know, learning about regular expressions to hardware hacking. We've got somebody doing a 3D printing demo. So we're trying to find a 3D printer for that. So
anyone have a 3D printer they want a loan to?
Yes, definitely.
Open Source Bridge.
You can email me at info@opensourcebridge.org.
That could happen as a result of this. Well, that sounds so exciting. But if you're not a programmer, What would be interesting? How would you know, I know that non-programmers are going to go. Like,
definitely.
I think, right, there's like some nonprofit. How can nonprofits, you know, use open source? Mm-hmm. There's some workshops like that. What are some other non-programming or hacking? I think that scares people.
Yeah, for sure. We have a lot of wiki contributors who come. So there's a lot about building community and writing and, you know, community editing and sharing of data, things like that. We also have a lot of designers who come and talk about, you know, making systems more accessible and open. And we also have just kind of writers in general. One of our media sponsors is the Recompiler Mag, and they are going to be having a zine hacking table in our hacker lounge. So you can come and like make zines that we can totally consider that hacking. You know, whatever makes sense for you, whatever you want to remix and share with the world, that fits into our model of open source.
So if you wanted to learn more about how, because anybody can make a wiki article.
Right.
Right. So if you want to learn how to add to wiki articles you've seen, or you have questions about that, or you want to learn about zines, you just want to observe and learn more about what open source is, if you're from a nonprofit, those will all be great. Anybody could really take away something.
For sure.
And tell us about the UnConference. What's that?
Yeah, the UnConference is the Friday day, and that is, anybody with a community pass is eligible for that, so you can come to that for free. And basically, everybody just gets together in the morning and proposes sessions, and the group decides what sessions are going to be offered that day, and you go to whatever is interesting to you. So sometimes that's people who've made talks that maybe weren't accepted because they didn't fit into the format, or maybe somebody just really wants to get together and talk about a specific project or something like that. So there's all sorts of different things that you can do during that time, and you'll have access to our Hacker Lounge, which has all sorts of fun soldering irons and Legos and awesome things like that for you to play with and hack on. So yeah, that's what our UnConference day is going to be like.
Well, I have one last question, and I can see you're a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I know that a lot of times, and maybe this is changing. I kind of have a feeling this is changing, but I know it's still kind of, you know, the tech and programming and hacking and everything kind of related to code is still very predominantly male.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the Open Source Bridge is different. Is it different?
I think it's different.
You have more women that
for
participate,
sure,
and you're organizing it.
Mm-hmm.
So talk a little bit about that, because I think sometimes you can feel, you know, if I go, will I have an opportunity to participate as a woman?
Right. And for Open Source Bridge, we try very hard to take a really holistic approach to diversity. So it's not just women for us. We, from the beginning, have done things like include accessibility lanes where we don't let people stand so that it's easy to navigate our space physically. We try and make sure that people of color have a place at the table, that we have people represented from, you know, all spectrums of like sexuality and gender. So our space is really unique in the open source world and in technology in general. And coming back to that is really tied to our theme of sustainability for this year. And to support some of those programs, we actually are just recently launched a crowdfunding campaign to coincide with this interview. And I promised a discount code for tickets, if that's okay for me to give out. We have a discount code OSB Generosity. If you sign up in the next week, for a ticket. And you can find more info about our crowdfunding campaign on the main page of our website.
You want to repeat the code one more time?
Sure. The code is OSB Generosity. And you can find the crowdfunding campaign on the main page of our website, which again is opensourcebridge.org.
Well, Shauna, thank you so much for dropping by and helping us understand what we can expect to see at the conference. It sounds really exciting. Oh, I forgot to ask you. Now, is there a fee to go? Is it a free event, or they can buy well, I guess they can buy tickets if there's a discount code.
Right, right. So there's registration available on our website, and there's several different levels to try and help it make it okay. There's several different levels depending on you know, what type of person you are, how your funds are set up. So we try and make it as accessible as possible. Just let us know if there's a problem.
And is there opportunities for people to volunteer?
Definitely. You can click on the Get Involved link on our website, and that will give you access to our volunteer coordinators who can get you set up.
Well, great. Just give us the date and the location and times one more time.
Sure. It's going to be June 21st through 24th at the Elliott Center in Portland, Oregon.
And that's about Southwest 12th and Salmon, or 1226 Southwest Salmon.
Yep.
Awesome. And they can go to the website, get more information, sign up to volunteer, get tickets. Thanks so much. We're going to be moving on to our next segment of today's Digital Divide. We'll hear an interview I did last week with Brian Christian, co-author of the new book, Algorithms to Live By, The Computer Science of Human Decisions. Just pour yourself a warm cup of milk, and we'll be talking about how hard science can improve many aspects of our lives and decision-making. To Live By, The Computer Science of Human Decisions is the newest book by Brian Christian and Tom Griffiths. Brian Christian has a background in computer science and philosophy and is the author of the national bestseller, The Most Human Human. His writing has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Wired, The Wall Street Journal, The Guardian, and The Paris Review. Brian Christian, welcome to The Digital Divide.
Thank you so much for having me.
You co-authored a book called Algorithms to Live By, The Computer Science of Human Decisions. And in the book, you explore the idea of human algorithm design, which sounds super nerdy and not even relevant to everyday life, but we know that it is relevant. So it's searching for better solutions to the challenges people encounter every day. And I'm kind of quoting from the book, it offers us practical, concrete suggestions for how to solve specific problems. Optimal stopping tells us when to look and when to leap. And so I covered some terms from the book. Mm-hmm. Some of them I want to wait till later in our conversation to talk about.
Sure.
Is that something you think that most people could use? Because don't you agree, most people make a lot of decisions with some percentage, or sometimes 100%, people make emotional decisions.
Yeah, I mean, the basic premise of the book is, you know, there's a huge class of problems that we humans face in everyday life, str- strictly as a consequence of having limited space and limited time, whether it's, you know, finding an apartment or deciding whether to go to our favorite restaurant for dinner or try something new, or how to deal with our overflowing closets at home. We think of these as intrinsically human problems, but the message of the book is they're not. They actually correspond to one of a fundamental set of problems from computer science, which gives us an opportunity to learn something about how to make better decisions day to day.
So as an example, an algorithm for dessert might look like, I can choose chocolate cake or fresh fruit. So then I have to think, if I say yes to cake, I then might think that's a lot of calories. And then no, which sends me over to fresh fruit, where I ask, does it have chocolate in it? And the answer is no. And then that sends me back to cake.
Right. So, you know, what you're describing is, you know, we think of algorithms as being the domain of giant tech companies like Google and Facebook. But really, the word algorithm just means a simple series of steps that you follow to solve a problem or make a decision. We already use algorithms in our everyday life. You know, we were taught math algorithms when we learned long division and you know, how to carry the one. But we also follow algorithms in the kitchen when we're following a recipe to make bread. And as you point out, a lot of the decisions that we make in life involve this thought process where we kind of walk ourselves through a series of steps and arrive at some kind of conclusion. But the thing is that we rarely subject our own intuitive decision-making algorithms to the kind of rigor that computer science can offer.
So you've said that an algorithm is any series of steps that solve a problem. So could we also say that an algorithm is a decision-making process that, you know, analyzes or refines a problem or question until we arrive at an answer, and the answer is always cake, right?
Always, it's always cake. That's the secret.
That seems very computerish. So how can people separate their emotional decision-making and use more logical decision-making?
Yeah, well, I actually think that one of the surprising messages of the book for people is that, you know, we have this idea that, quote-unquote, thinking like a computer means this kind of Spock-like process of, you know, considering every possible outcome and thinking everything all the way through and arriving at an exact answer with total certainty. And in fact, this is not even what computers do when they're faced with the hardest classes of problems, which most real-world problems that you and I face belong to. Surprisingly, to many people's notion of how computers work, when they're up against the hardest class of problems, computers will turn to chance. They will use randomness. They will make approximations. They'll arrive at an answer with only partial degree of certainty. And most importantly, I think, they will trade off the cost of making an error versus the cost of delay. And so I think that's one of the intrinsic things that's relevant to any human decision, is simply the question of how long should I think and when should I just take action. And so that is one of the fundamental classes of problems that we consider in the book, which are called optimal stopping problems. When to continue to gather information and when to just act on what you have.
In your book, you do give a number of real-world examples, like, you know, renting an apartment or cleaning out your closet and culling things. And one of them really caught my eye, and it's something that you yourself tested, where you said, paradoxically, people are more likely to be available if you request a meeting for next Tuesday at noon than for any convenient time. And
right.
You called it a constrained problem is much easier to handle than a wide open one. That ultimately, computer science strives to minimize the computation. But what if everyone requested meetings for next Tuesday at noon? Doesn't that break it?
Well, you certainly have to turn down a lot of meetings, that's for sure. The basic idea that's operating here that you're speaking to is what we call in the book computational kindness. And so the basic idea here is that our interactions with other people, in effect, pose them computational problems that we're asking them to solve. And there is a unexpected bridge from computer science to ethics from the perspective of what actions can we take to minimize the computational labor that we're imposing on other people. And so, for example, as you say, you know, when you're scheduling a time to meet, the traditional rules of etiquette would say, be as wide open as possible, be as flexible, be as deferential to the other person's preferences and constraints and so forth. But from a practical perspective, that can look like passing the cognitive buck, you know, saying, we have this shared task, which is scheduling this meeting or deciding where to go out to lunch or whatever, and I'm just going to defer all of that computation to you.
Now, you're really making that other person do all the heavy lifting, because they have to check their calendar and they have to be initiating the, does this work for you, does this work for you, as opposed
exactly.
to putting out
yeah.
this date or this date, which is much easier to look and see, oh yeah, I am available one of those, or I'm not, how about this? They're already in the process then, and they don't have to, right, as you said, pass the buck and
exactly.
and put the weight of gathering the data, really.
Yeah, I mean, in computer science, there is a classic result that verifying whether a given solution, in fact, solves a problem or not is much easier than finding the solution from scratch. And so this, I think, is a great analogy for the meeting scheduling situation, where you can say to someone, does this work, yes or no, rather than show me something that works or give me something that works. And, you know, for me, there's two points here. One is that it cuts against the grain of what we normally think of as, you know, good conversational etiquette. This is actually the opposite of what we normally think of as being polite. But it's not entirely incompatible, because you can imagine writing to someone and saying, are you available at noon Tuesday? If not, let me know and we can, you know, find some other time. You can be ultimately as deferential, but merely by suggesting something concrete, you're giving them an easy way to resolve the problem. And we make the argument that you can think of this as an act of computational kindness.
Really, and you're setting yourself up to be more successful, but, you know, and to achieve your goal of making a meeting with someone by starting that way, as opposed to leaving it so open-ended.
Yeah, exactly.
Because nobody has any time. You know, when you think about it, you're like, never would be a good time because I'm so busy. But when someone offers you something tangible and concrete, it is much easier to digest and process.
Right. And so there's that tension between the normal rules of etiquette and the reality, which is that people actually do find this much more agreeable and much more easy to manage. And so thinking in computational terms gives us a way to make sense of that.
In your book, you are suggesting that people would apply algorithms in their decision-making process, but more intentionally.
Yeah, I mean, the basic idea is that we already have, you know, these intuitive ways of approaching the problems in our lives. And in many cases, they do not look drastically different from the recommendations of computer science. But what computer science can offer us is, you know, at the first level, simply a vocabulary for understanding the kinds of problems that we're up against. So, for example, the question of deciding whether to go to your favorite restaurant or a new restaurant is an example of what computer scientists would call an explore-exploit dilemma.
That problem is so huge, it can often result in not going out to any restaurant at all.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, this is a case where intuitively we understand that a life well lived is some combination of trying new things and being open to new experiences, but also making sure that you spend plenty of time doing the things that you know and love. What we don't know is exactly what that balance should be or what that balance should look like. And so this is a case where computer scientists have, in their own way, been working on finding that exact balance for now more than 50, 60 years. And so there's a real opportunity, I think a genuine opportunity, for us to learn something applicable to our own lives by examining the shape that those solutions take and what the basic principles are. And I think there's some wisdom there that's actually relevant to us in our everyday decisions.
Here's where things get even more nerdy, and I'm going to quote from the book. You write, "We know this because finding an apartment belongs to a class of mathematical problems known as optimal stopping," which you mentioned earlier. And then you talk about the 37% rule defines a simple series of steps, what computer scientists call an algorithm for solving these problems. And as it turns out, you write, "Apartment hunting is just one of the ways that optimal stopping rears its head in daily life." You also said dating.
Yes.
Tell us more about that.
Yeah, the basic premise of what makes something an optimal stopping problem is that you're faced with a series of options that you evaluate one at a time. And at each step of the way, you must either decide to take the option in front of you and never know what else might have been out there, or you turn it down, in which case you don't have the opportunity to go back. And so this is a structure that I think describes a lot of situations that we find ourselves in life, whether it's looking for an apartment or house hunting, where you see a property and you either make an application or you make a bid right away, or you let that opportunity pass because you want to see what else is out there, or you're still kind of getting a sense of what the market looks like.
But you used an example of look at 11 apartments and then take the next one that most closely matches your criteria. You said statistically that's the one.
Yeah, there's a famous result in optimal stopping that we call the 37% rule, which is, if you want the very best chance of finding the very best apartment, spend exactly 37% of your search non-committally exploring your options, and after that point, be willing to immediately commit to the first place you see that's better than what you saw in that first 37%. And as we say in the book, this is not merely an intuitively satisfying compromise between looking and leaping. This is the provably optimal result. This is the method that gives you the highest chance of getting the very best outcome.
Right, and then statistically, after that best one, the choices go down and become fewer or not as optimal matches.
Yeah, I mean, the basic premise is that you don't know what makes something, a truly good option until you've had enough experience in that domain to be able to say. And so, if you move to a new city and you see an apartment and they say, it's $1,200 a month, and you think, okay, it looks pretty nice, but you don't necessarily know, is that a good or bad deal at that price? And
right.
You've seen what else is out there. But the very act of seeing what else is out there may cost you the opportunity to get that first place. And so, this is a structure that some people have argued also describes our romantic lives, that dating has the same structure where you're in a relationship and you have to make this decision of, am I going to commit to this person and not know whoever else might have been out there? Or do I walk away to meet other people and get more information, but I may find that that person was my best match and I've now given up that opportunity? So we don't, of course, endorse explicitly applying the 37% rule to your love life and just immediately proposing to the next great person that you meet after you are 37% of the way through your dating life.
And definitely don't explain it to them that way.
No. No, we include, in fact, some cautionary tales of computer scientists and mathematicians explicitly applying optimal stopping theory to their dating life. And I will say that the results are mixed. It doesn't always go according to plan.
Doesn't always work. So in the future, do you see people using, people are probably already using apps that help them in decision-making processes, but maybe even more so in the future. Do you think that people will be using computers to help them determine best outcomes, or will we just use our brains?
I think it's likely to be a hybrid of the two. I mean, I certainly think that there is an opportunity for us to leverage computers to make better decisions. And I think one of the most important things in doing so is first recognizing what kind of a problem we're facing, right? So it's easy to imagine having an app on your phone that tells you when you're 37% of the way through some process. But what's required of you in order to make that work is to recognize when you're in an optimal stopping problem or when you're in an explore.
Right.
And so one of the things that I think this book can really offer people is a way of thinking in computational terms and a vocabulary for identifying and recognizing these problems when they come up in our daily life.
In the book, you talk about intractable problems. Explain to our listeners what that means.
Yeah. So one of the landmark results in theoretical computer science is, in so many words, there is a class of problems that are just simply hard. And
like world peace, that would be a hard problem.
World peace is a great example because, you know, any negotiation involves not only having a sense of what you want and a sense of what the other person wants, but it involves this, there's a term in computer science, recursion, which means simulating the mind of the other person who is themselves simulating your own mind. Right, so in any kind of diplomatic situation or negotiation, you not only have to recognize what you think and what you believe the other person thinks, but you need to consider what you think they think you think, and so forth and so forth. And so this is a classic example of an intractable problem, where simply having access to a computer or a supercomputer even does not magically enable you to solve the problem. The problem is really so hard that you need to give up on the idea of an exact, precise, certain solution. And so one of the things we explore in the book is, what do computer scientists do when they face an intractable problem? Obviously, they don't simply give up. Rather, they have a series of techniques and strategies for kind of taming the problem and getting it under control. But this means giving up on some of the things that we normally think of as being the hallmarks of, you know, rational decision making.
Mm-hmm.
So up against an intractable problem, a computer will not consider all of its options, but rather will weigh the costs of delay in thinking longer against the cost of making an error. And it will not necessarily operate deterministically. It might use randomness. And it will not necessarily always give a solution that is 100% certain, but may instead strive for a solution that is close to the best or a solution that is probably the best. In these cases, what computers do sounds an awful lot like what we do when we're up against a hard problem.
Right, because life is full of unexpected variables, right? So how can algorithms offer us the best decision when we can, and maybe that's what you're talking about, we can never truly have all of the variables or factors before us, and there are always unintended consequences we can't predict based on those variables.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And so there's a concept in computer science that's called overfitting. And the basic idea behind overfitting is, if you don't have all the information, or the information that you have is not 100% trustworthy, then making a decision that is perfectly optimized to the information that you have may actually be a huge problem if you don't have all the information or you don't have the right information. And this is one of those things, I think, in making any decision where, you know, we go back to Benjamin Franklin's advice to make a, you know, pros and cons list and write down every possible reason you can think of for taking some action and every possible reason you can think of for not taking it, and then, you know, cross out the ones that are equal and see which one has more stuff left over. This, you know, I think satisfies our intuitive notion of making a super rational decision. But one of the dangers of this approach is that you actually end up making a big decision for what ends up being a minor factor. People, I think, would find it counterintuitive, but in fact, computer scientists themselves know better than anyone that when you are faced with uncertainty, there is a real advantage to simplicity and to not overthinking things and to not gathering too much information. And so this is one of the concepts in the book that's called regularization, which is basically giving credit for simplicity, that a method that's more complex, or a thought process that's more complex, must really earn its keep. Otherwise, you should just keep things as simple as possible.
How about keep things the same?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes that might be an option as well.
Right. And, you know, we... To not take action is itself a decision, right?
It is. That's right.
Yeah, exactly.
Explain what you mean by the tension between exploration and exploitation.
Yeah. So this gets back to the idea of, you know, when do we go to our favorite restaurant and when do we try the new place that just opened up down the street? The basic idea here is that in a lot of areas in life, we have to make a choice between gathering more information, which in computer science is called exploration, and leveraging the information that we already have to get a good outcome, which in computer science is called exploitation. And there's this famous problem in computer science called the multi-armed bandit problem that involves this idea where you walk into a casino and there are all these different slot machines, some of which pay off better than others, but you don't know which are which. And so if you're going to spend the afternoon in the casino, what do you do to try to make the most money? Well, intuitively, it's going to involve some combination of just trying different things out, pulling levers at random. And as you gain knowledge, as you gain information about which machines seem more promising, you want to start allocating more and more of your attention and your money and your time towards those. And so the basic intuition here, I mean, in the book we explore some of the actual algorithms involved, but the basic intuition, the basic principle, is that exploration is most valuable when you're at the beginning of a process. If you think about moving to a new city, the very first night that you go out, you're completely 100% guaranteed. Let's say you move to Portland.
Mm-hmm.
The first night you go out, that restaurant is literally the best restaurant you've ever been to in Portland, right? Guaranteed.
Literally.
The second night has a 50% chance of being the best restaurant you've ever been to in Portland. But the odds of making a new discovery that's better than what you already know about will go down as a function of your experience and your knowledge. And likewise, the value of making a new discovery is much greater at the beginning of your time in a city than it is at the end, right? There's something almost tragic about finding a really great restaurant your final night in town. It's like, oh, if only I'd known about this years ago.
Yes.
So the basic premise here is that, in general, you should explore more when you are at the beginning of your time, and you should exploit more, use your knowledge to go to the places that you know are going to be good when you're at the end of your time. This, I think, is quite profound because it offers us a way of thinking not only about, you know, how to approach a vacation or a year abroad or life in a city, but it gives us a way of thinking about the entire arc of a human life, that we are all of us on this trajectory from exploration to exploitation simply as a function of how much time we have left to enjoy the new things that we find.
That is so fascinating.
Yeah.
I was disappointed, though, that the multi-armed bandit question remains unsolved. I was hoping to employ some kind of winning strategy on my next casino visit.
Well, it depends. If you know exactly how many tokens you have and exactly how many machines there are, then there is an exact solution by following a method known as dynamic programming. So if you find this relevant in your next trip to Vegas, you can find all the details in the end notes at the back of the book.
That's hilarious. This is Rabia Yamin, your host today, and I am talking with Brian Christian, co-author of Algorithms to Live By, The Computer Science of Human Decisions. In the book, Brian, you write, big tech firms such as Amazon and Google began carrying out live A-B, those are called split tests, on their users starting in about 2000. And over the following years, the internet has become the world's largest controlled experiment. What are these companies exploring and exploiting? In a word, you write, you, whatever it is that makes you move your mouse and open your wallet.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well,
yeah. So this is one of the things where anytime you use a computer and log onto the internet, you are taking part in someone else's exploit problem. And this has become one of the critical methods for any tech company, any web company. So the basic idea here is, for example, this was very instrumental in the first Obama campaign in 2008. They had this bright red button that said donate. And they thought, what can we do to make more people donate money to this campaign? Well, let's think about what word we want to put on that button and what image we want to show next to that button. And we'll just run some tests where we show some people one image and some people another image, and some people get to see a button that says donate and other people get to see a button that says contribute or donate and get a free T-shirt. And we'll just start collecting data on which version of the website seems to get the most donations for the campaign.
So basically, when you land on the website, a user would see one of two or three different versions of a page with that different button, and they were measuring how many people interacted with that button on each of the three pages when they landed on it to see which was more appealing or interesting to people.
Exactly, exactly. And by doing this, which is known as A-B testing, by A-B testing their button and their media images, they were able to raise an additional $57 million for the campaign just by trying different images and different bits of messaging on the button, which I think is really remarkable. And so from these early successes, this technique of A-B testing websites has become just an absolutely essential part of how all online commerce is done. And these days, all of the presidential campaigns are doing this. Amazon is doing this. Google famously A-B tested 41 different shades of the color blue for one of their buttons several years ago. So this is really, the internet has become, in effect, the world's largest controlled experiment, and we are all of us part of it.
I think it's exciting.
I think it is exciting, and it allows companies to make discoveries on an almost continual basis, especially, if you're a company like Google or Facebook that has millions of people using the site at any given time,
right.
You can really experiment with what would seem like very minor changes, but even tiny subtle things can have a big effect when you've got that many users.
Yes, so, right, and they're learning about human behavior. They're studying human behavior, and then the part that was so disturbing for everyone is, the selling and marketing of that to manipulate us to buy products.
Right, right. So, yeah, the question is, how should there be limits to how good that this technology gets? But I think one of the most profound aspects of this is that there is something of a revolution happening in the medical community as a result of the success of these A-B testing methods in software companies. So you can think of an A-B test as being in some ways analogous to a clinical trial. So in a clinical trial, you have some conventional treatment and then you have some experimental treatment. The same way that on a website, you have the default version of the website and then you have these new variations that you're trying. And software companies have, over the last 20 years, developed very sophisticated and very successful algorithms for determining how many users should see which version as a result of how well they've performed over the course of the test. And so if you start running a test and the experimental version appears to be doing much better than the normal version of the site, then you'll actually start showing it to more people as the test continues. This is in contrast to your classic randomized controlled medical trial, in which you just divide your participants, your patients, into two groups, and you give half of the people one drug and half of the people the other drug for the entire duration of the test.
Or a placebo.
Or a placebo, right. You're right, your control group. So there's really a movement of people saying, wait a minute, the software industry has really revolutionized the way that we should be thinking about clinical trials. We should not just be running them as these sort of 50-50 tests, but we should be running them dynamically and adaptively, just as they do on the web. And so there's a growing community of doctors and statisticians and computer scientists urging for some kind of change and some kind of modernization of the clinical trial. And indeed, the FDA just last year released what's called a draft guidance document, suggesting that they are thinking about using some of these very techniques in medical device and drug tests. So it's very encouraging, and it's very interesting.
It is exciting. I was reading what Yukio Noguchi had to say about optimal filing systems and how he arrived at his results of the yes. one pile is more efficient and effective than a filing system that separates papers into organized label folders. And I know a lot of our listeners are going to appreciate this. So as crazy as it sounds, he says, yeah. one of the most efficient ways to organize papers on your desk is just to place them in a big pile, and you write about this in the book. Then whenever you pull a document from the middle of the pile, you simply put it back on top, he wrote. Statistically, this gives you the optimal order. The more likely you are to want any given item, the more likely it is to be near the top of the stack. This one made me feel like winning.
Yes, I think this is one of these tremendously surprising results and one of these cases where I think most of us, we have some big pile of documents on our desk or our table, and we feel sort of guilty about it. We have this feeling of, you know, I should really get organized. And there is this startling verdict from computer science that says, you are organized. This is, in fact, the optimal structure for organizing this information. And as it turns out, simply putting documents back on the top of the pile after you're done using them results in a structure that will it will only cost you twice as much time looking for things as if you had been clairvoyant and had known in advance what you were going to need when and could structure it accordingly. It is only twice as bad as being able to see the future. And no algorithm, no method for organizing those papers can do any better than that, which I think is just quite a remarkable result.
It is. I was so happy.
Yeah, this really vindicates what we do by default and feel bad about it when, in fact, we may be smarter than we realize.
I hope so. I hope that's true. So how'd you get involved in a book on this subject matter?
My academic background started in computer science and philosophy, and so I've always been interested in both of those things separately and kind of the intersection of those.
This is like the happiest marriage of both of those things.
yeah, quite. And, you know, I think we have a sense that we ought to turn to a discipline like philosophy for help in thinking about ethics and, you know, human mortality and the questions of life. But surprisingly, I found that computer science was just as useful, if not more so, as a way for thinking about the problems that I was facing in my own life. And so this book is really the outgrowth of that way of thinking. And it's a collaboration between myself and my good friend Tom Griffiths, who is a psychologist and cognitive scientist at the University of California at Berkeley. And he and I have known each other for 11 years now, and I think it's fair to say that the book grew out of kind of a joint obsession and a joint fascination with these questions that really unfolded over a series of conversations that he and I had been having for many years about applying some of the methods and insights from computer scientists to the problems we were facing in our own lives. And several years ago,
dating problems.
Yeah, this question of, you know, just in general, how do you know when to stop considering new options, which I think is relevant. It was certainly relevant to dating, but relevant pretty much in any decision.
It is relevant to any decision, but I love that it's relevant to dating.
Yes. So I just recently got engaged, in fact, and my fiance tells me that one of our early conversations, I described the 37% rule to her and said that, you know, some people have argued that 37% of the way through one's dating life happens roughly around 26, 27 years old. And I had met her when we were both 28 years old. So apparently, I don't recall this conversation at all, but it sounds like the kind of thing I would say, you know, where I sort of foreshadowed that, you know, we're now in the leaping phase of one's dating life, and so if this really works out, then, you know, I'm all in. And it turns out that we were, so then
That's hilarious. Right. It's not the kind of conversation that you would, you know, want to really go that deep into the statistical probabilities.
Right. I mean, you don't want to just slavishly follow some, you know, prescription without applying some of your own judgment, of course.
Right.
But it does, I think, give us a way of making sense of some of the intuitive ways that we have of thinking about questions.
Well, I think it's a great way to make decisions. Some decisions are harder, and as you get older in life, making bigger decisions that don't allow you that recoup time that you have when you're younger. You know, if you make mistakes, you don't really have that as you get older. Mm-hmm. To big life decisions like should I move, should I sell my house or rent my house, things like that become, you know, should I take on a car payment or not take on a car payment. These, if you have those types of choices, they become harder as you age, because if you made a bad decision or if variables present themselves that you didn't anticipate, your ability to be flexible is less because you don't have as much time.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a sense in which our decision-making should naturally and correctly change as a function of how much time we have left. And certainly this is a big part of the ideas behind the explore-exploit.
And that's not morbid. That's just statistics, right?
Correct. And I mean, I think in some ways it's the opposite of morbid from the perspective that, you know, taking the casino slot machine metaphor for the explore-exploit problem.
Yes.
We should naturally expect that someone who's been in the casino longer is probably getting better payouts on average than someone who's just shown up. And so we should actually assume from that logic that, in fact, we should get happier as we go through life because we know what we want and we know what we like. And the things that we value and hold most dear are, in fact, quite good because we've been able to select them through our life experience. You know, our favorite restaurant at age 60 is at least as good as the best restaurant we knew about when we were 20, you know, by definition.
We've answered more questions. As we age, we've answered more of life's questions. So we don't have kind of as much groping around for answers, hopefully, that more youthful people have.
Yeah, so this is one of the things we talk about in the Explore-Exploit chapter, is that ideas forged by computer scientists in the Explore-Exploit problem are now coming to inform psychologists and cognitive scientists who think about both the very young and the very old. So in the book, we give the example of the cognitive scientist Allison Gopnik at the University of California, who works on infant cognition. And, you know, if you think about infants, we have these stereotypes that they're basically, you know, random. You know, they'll just put any object in the house into their mouth. They have a really short attention span. They're always kind of fiddling with things, and they always prefer new toys to their current toys. Allison Gopnik is able to make an argument that says, well, from the perspective of the explore-exploit trade-off, that is exactly what someone should do. You know, the first minute they walk in the casino, they should just start pulling handles at random. That's what seems like the right thing to do. And so, in fact, you know, we can think about the behavior of infants as being optimal from the perspective of exploration, that one really should just try everything out at the beginning of one's life. And so, you know, even a behavior that seems kind of random, like just putting every item in your house into your mouth once to see if it, you know, it's food or not, makes sense from the perspective of someone who's just kind of pulling the handles in life's casino.
And once again, demonstrating that the older you are, the more you can distinguish between what is food and what is not food.
Yes, exactly. Among the many things that we learn as we go through life.
How does AI factor into this thinking or these processes?
When we think about the huge progress that AI has made over the last 10, 15 years, I think there's something in particular that's quite striking about it, which is that, you know, AI has proven capable of doing a lot of the things that human experts do, whether it's, you know, a chess grandmaster or a math whiz.
And we want to really thank you for tuning in to The Digital Divide today. This is your host, Rabia Yemen. And we're just maybe about 5 minutes shy of the end of the interview, but the whole interview is up on the KBOO website, kboo.fm. You can look for this episode of The Digital Divide for May, Friday the 13th, May 2016. And you can listen to the last little bit if you just need a little more. Coming up next is Moving On. So you know the deal. Keep your radio turned on and your radio will keep you turned on. Until the second Friday of June, this is Rabia Yemen.
Yes. 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 This cold, this water, this sun, this daughter, this day, this time, this land, it's all mine. This calling bell, this forge bell, this dark bell, this the knife bell, this calling, this burden, this falling, the world. I understood this in the deep wood. This, ah, there I stood, a child so fair.
The time is 12 noon. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Pan-African Film Series. This month, May 18th at 6 p.m., will be A Message from Women in Gambia at the Smith Student Union at Portland State University. A Message from the Women of Gambia will feature young women organizers from the All-African Women's Revolutionary Union and the All-African